There's just a few of us, so we can do anything.
You had started talking about the foundation, foundation work, like the mandala. I wouldn't mind hearing the whole story, or that's sort of a vague question, but I thought that might be an interesting subject to pursue.
Yeah, it is. It is very interesting. I was just talking about seven of those, seven of the 30 some offerings of the mandala offering. First of all, the mandala offering is dimensional. I don't have a copy of it here, but when you get to the dakinis, you're on the second level. When you get the different goddesses, the goddess of music, the goddess of dance, and that, you know, you're on the second level. The first level is the continents, and each of the continents has a sun and a moon, and then each of the continents has a kind of an attribute quality, and then each of the continents has another, I don't know what I would call that one. And then you get to the dakinis, and that's the second level. And then when you get to the top level, the third level, that's where you have the whole of the mandala offering is this pyramid, this four-sided pyramid, coming up to a peak, and at the point where it comes to a peak, then there is another pyramid that meets it from heaven. Mm. That's what you're doing. Mm. And so it is like that center point that in another movement it becomes the Star of David, you know, where the two pyramids interact. And they're totally balanced, and that center point is like a diamond light in the center. So this is the offering. This is where the two forces meet, and there's a total flow of energy and an offering between them. So the mandala offering is actually is offering. When I do a mandala offering in the morning, and I do three different prayers of offering. One of the offerings is the objects of my attraction, aversion, and ignorance, friend, enemy, and stranger, my body, wealth, and all that is visible without any sense of loss. I offer this. By virtue of this offering, may all beings here and now attain the happiness of that pure now. That's the second one. The first prayer I do is the ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flowers. How you do that is you take the ground. I have a mirror that's about that wide. It's a circle. And you take a few grains of rice and you sprinkle them on the surface. Then with this part of your arm, you do three rounds of polishing the mirror with the rice. Om Ahum, one, counterclockwise. Om Ahum, two. Om Ahum, three. That is dissolving all of the fixed views of body, speech, and mind. Once, twice, and three times. Naming the aspiration, and more grains, then you dump those, then more grains of rice. So that's like purifying the fixed view, and then naming the aspiration of Namo Guru Be, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sangaha. Naming the aspiration of the Guru consciousness and the manifestation of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Namo Guru Be, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sangha. Clockwise, bringing this into existence three times. Right? And you dump that. So that's how you prepare the base. Right? And then you do, the ground is purified, it's now purified ground. And that also represents the whole of your own mind, the whole of your life and your involvement with your family and your friends all around you, the whole energy movement of all the universal energy movement of solar system and planets, all the wheels within wheels of all activity, coming into being, existing, and passing away. Inner, outer, all dances. And then it's, the ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flowers. It is adorned with Meru, king of mountains. King of mountains is the same as the refuge tree. It is that center point of the universe. It's the very center point of the universe where everything is balanced. The point where creation and dissolution arise from and return to. It is a part of one's own being. And it doesn't move and it doesn't shake because it both comes into time and is not in time. It's the great axis of the universe. In all mythology, you'll find this referred to. The ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flowers. It is adorned with Meru, king of mountains. The four quarters of the universe. And I was taught that if you're really going to be respectful, you don't pour the rice this way. You mix your rice with gemstones and seeds, by the way. You do it this way, which is extremely difficult. It's kind of like with the offering bowls. It makes you have to pay attention. It's really disgusting. It's a disgusting thing, but there you go. So I was busily just doing it this way because you can really whip those metal offerings off, you know, when you do it like that. Piles of rice everywhere, you know, I mean, the dust is almost rising. And someone kindly, oh, no, the proper way is always through your fingers. Boy, that's hard. So, you create the mandala, the short mandala like that, the sun and the moon, is purified, scented water, strewn with flowers, is endowed with the four quarters of the universe as well as the sun and the moon. So the four quarters of the universe are basically, in terms of the mandala offering, of you doing the mandala offering and creating it, they are basically the four continents. I was talking about the four desires and the four yogas, right? That Kriya Yoga. And this the smile, Charya Yoga, and the laugh, Kriya Yoga Tantra, Charya Yoga Tantra, Yoga Tantra, and Anuttara Yoga Tantra. I must have left my tongue in the restaurant. Or maybe with the orchids, probably with the orchids. Those are when they're not used for coming out of delusion, they are the four ways that consciousness can find rebirth in the Tibetan cosmology. So the four continents are the one where people who are born from the smile, people who are reborn from the laugh, beings who are reborn from the laugh, beings who are reborn from the hand holding, beings who are reborn from the total embrace, right? And they're called, I bet you I got it right here. Because of the four desires, the four elements come together. Because of the look, a clear reflection in the watery element, and moist seed causes spontaneous generation to ripen beneath the water. With the laugh, the windy element rises and vibrates. The wind's virtue and the seed bring about birth from the womb. Pressure of the hands and the clutching of bodies that clutch the earth's body is born from an egg. to embrace and give rise to the element fire and heat, birth occurs from the moisture of a stirred seed. And emerging from the four desires, beings are scattered over the four continents. Those born in pure Videhi are born by apparition. Those born in Jambu Dvipa, which is where this earth and our human realm manifest. Now, these aren't physical places, these are planes of existence. Like there are dogs all over the earth. And there's a dog consciousness, but there's a kind of dog here, a kind of dog there. Do you understand? Are born from a womb. Apara Godana are born from an egg, and Uttara Kuni are born of moisture. So what you're talking about here is all the possible ways that a consciousness can manifest in the universe working with the elements. And how easily that consciousness can actually start to think, oh, this is mine, I should be working with this, and forget that this is a long process, a long journey, that interests come over lifetimes, that interests can be lost in a lifetime. You understand that? So the four continents are each a different shape to represent the possible interests or the possible draw that would bring one into this lifetime or that lifetime or this lifetime or that lifetime. In the Abhidhamma, they talk about the four types of birth as well. This is a very old idea, a very basic idea in Buddhism. It goes back to Hindu tradition, actually. That doesn't make it right. It is nice, however, to look at it and understand where it comes from, not just think it's some weird idea. It's a very ancient idea. And I have found some virtue in it, but I just want you to understand that the four quarters of the universe, each of them has a sun and a moon sort of energy, and a kind of a blessing, something that is, like one of them has... Which one is it? I think it's Apara Godana has the wish-fulfilling cow. A cow, or that means that the blessing or the energy or the totem of that place is that whatever is wanted in terms of the nectar of satisfying desire is easily done there. But probably insight is a lot harder to come by. So every one of these continents has something that is laid on. This does happen there. And also something that is laid off. So when you're doing this kind of offering, you're also looking at yourself and your own tendencies and how you tend to be blind here or fall into self-pity there or, you know, do you understand? And not pay attention. Is this interesting to you? Or not?
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Okay. So you're doing the four... The ground is purified with scented water and strewn with flowers. It is adorned with Meru, king of mountains, the four quarters of the universe. That's what the four quarters are. Four types of birth driven by cause and effect, dependent on causes. An effect occurs. Right? And there are four main types of birth. That's the four continents. As well as the sun and the moon. The sun and moon is... I think just leave it as the sun and moon because it's basically the two types of energy, you know. You could call it male-female if you want to. You could call it whatever you want to. But basically, I think just leaving it as the sun and the moon is quite reasonable. Coming into existence and passing away or whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. Just that main energy of duality. And then so then what you have created is basically a totem, a magical field, which if you work with it properly and you imagine it to be also your own life and your own thoughts and your own possibilities and what is around you and your own aspirations, and you actually offer it for the sake of all beings, that has a very powerful effect, because generosity begins in the mind. Does it not? It is the desire to help others that makes the action occur. So by the time 100,000 times you have wished to offer everything in your being for the sake of all beings, you're not so clingy. You don't tend to grasp. You're not so frightened of what you don't have. You begin to experience that flow of the heart. Just on a very pragmatic level, this exercise works. Then you take it a level deeper. Not just that I wish to share everything I have with all beings, and I wish, you know, so that we're not blindly born in the four continents caught by the poles of the sun and moon, that we understand the center point from which all things arise. You understand? Because it's there too. It's there in the mandala too. So then the second level is more like the objects of my attachment, aversion, and ignorance. That is to say, the causes. Not just what I have now, not just the effects. But there is an effect there. Here's an effect right in front of me. Oh, a red ball. Oh my God. I'm really attached to that. So that attachment creates the next reality that will come. So at first level, you're talking about the effects, that you're offering the effects of what has happened before. Second level, you're offering the causes that will create the future. The objects of my attachment, aversion, and ignorance. And what was it I was quoting now to Rinpoche saying the other day? It was... The idea that drives you shapes you. The idea that drives you shapes you. So look at what you're doing here. You're taking the ideas that usually drive you and you're turning them into an offering. Isn't that powerful? Isn't that powerful? It's a very powerful thing to do. Friend, enemy, and stranger. My body, wealth, and all enjoyments, without any sense of loss, I offer them. Please accept this offering and bless me with release from the three poisons. Three poisons are greed, hatred, and delusion. This is like offering the motives that cause one pain and others pain. And then the third prayer is to the Lama, who is the manifestation of the three bodies. I offer all that is visible, all outer and inner manifestation. Please grant me the supreme realization. Amen. So this is like totality union with the principle of awakening. That's the third level. So that's the short mandala offering. The long mandala offering, which you should probably do them together. If you're actually working with a mandala offering, I found it useful. And I probably have not done 100,000. I don't know, because I never have counted them. I've certainly done 100,000 of the short mandala offering. I don't know. I found it useful to do a certain number of long ones, and then an hour of short ones and then a certain number of long ones when I was doing the practice. And the long ones are naming like the 30, is it 37 piles or 30?
Seems to be, I can't quite be sure.
37 piles, which are representing that whole pyramid shaped up, which it's helpful to draw. I've done several drawings of it. If you want, next time I can bring more information about that so you can make copies of it and work with it. In the long one, you have the very specific things that you're offering that are really easy to get really bored by if you're a Westerner. Like, why would you offer the precious general? General who? You know? Precious minister, maybe, you know. The elephant with six tusks? I don't think so. Do you understand? When those come up, it's, I think for many Westerners, that's very difficult. But if you understand that the elephant with six tusks represents the mind that is unmovable and intelligent, and the six tusks is the white elephant, it's the royal elephant. And it's the six tusks, so there's power, it's power. And the six tusks represent the six paramis. The perfection of the six paramis results in equanimity. So of the seven factors of enlightenment, this elephant with six tusks is equanimity.
There was one in the Vietnamese temple here in the north. I used to use occasionally. And they had a white elephant with six tusks. Mm-hmm. The first time I'd seen one.
So how far do you want me to go with that? Is that enough for now, the sketch?
That's enough for me.
Good. Anything else you want to?
I was curious about the seeds and the jewels in the rice. They're symbolic of...
of everything you want to grow and all your riches that you're offering.
Okay. I mean, it felt good when you said it, but I was just...
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I've done a few of them. I haven't really been into this field very far. The periods where I undertake it and only go a certain length. I found some beryl and mica and crystal and semi-precious stones, a handful, and just the flow, the feeling of that you were suddenly very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And you had a lot to give, and you felt a sparkle going out. And I got lots of this, and I really made it this kind of thing. But it spread it around. It's just you don't think much about it as I did, but it's just a feeling that you are rich in potential. Creating a kind of a flow of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, my ring, you know. Give me this, you can never go back to it.
It's a beautiful practice.
I think it's a little daunting to us when we think of the number of times. I think it's the last one to get finished. Well, some people maybe not. It probably depends upon psychological types. Or...
I know that for a lot of people, they don't understand it at all. It's just a form.
Strange. Right?
And that I know a lot of people who think it has to do with being, you know, being creative. Can you do 100,000 mandalas? You know, oh well. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And in a way, it does. Being creative and dissolving it, giving it away. How creatively can you practice generosity? It really helped me understand them better to place them next to the tantras. So what should we talk about? We just got us. That whole idea of, you know, whatever drives you, shapes you, is such a powerful idea. Yeah, you should start thinking about, okay, well, who do you want to shape for the next being who is going to be born from what it is that is your activity? And start practicing that thought. Maybe it's practicing love in space, and start practicing that thought. So that is what will arise when the binding that holds this lifetime together is no longer functioning. For most people, when they die, there isn't a strong thought or a strong passion. There's sort of just a general feeling of their life going by, or the kids left home, or did they, you know? Most people, when they die, they're not sure whether they have children or they are siblings when they're older. The memory breaks down. So you look at somebody and you call your niece by your sister's name when you're 70 or 80. Someone walks in and they look like your sister, so you call them by that name and you think that they're there, and you talk about people who have been dead. You think that you're there, and that's the idea that is happening. So that whole thing, if I actually allow myself to look at that whole statement of what it is that drives you, shapes you. That's a very interesting statement.
So are you saying that you can choose what will drive you?
Yes. Mm. That you do choose it, but most of the time without paying attention. Most of the time just depending on which direction the sun is coming in the window, or... Yeah. Mm. That's a very interesting statement. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very powerful statement.
I have a question, but I'm not quite sure how to articulate it. It has to do with, you know, we kind of brought up the topic of free will last time. And so, and I think we decided there wasn't really any such thing as free will, but at the same time, we do have choice.
Yeah.
I have a question about that, but I'm not quite sure.
In every moment, there is choice. Just the same way, if you flip a coin, every time you flip a coin, what chance is there of heads or tails coming up?
It's 50-50.
And what about if a head turns up and then you flip it again? What's the chance?
Still 50-50.
And what about if heads turn up 20 times in a row? What's the chance?
Still 50-50.
What about if 1,000,000 times it turns up? What's the chance?
Still
50-50. Exactly. It's exactly the same. There is always the choice. There is always the possibility. It's exactly that same truth. It's exactly that same truth. You know, what has always been is not a valid reason for something to continue.
Right.
There is a choice to allow it to continue. Every moment is a new moment. Mm-hmm. Isn't that scary? Isn't that scary? Every moment is a new moment. or like they say, those Buddhist smart asses, samsara is nirvana.
So it goes back to view.
Well, it certainly does. What drives you shapes you. It's a very powerful statement. And there's actually two things shaping. What is driving you in terms of view, and what is driving you in terms of emotions. And they're hooked together. And they're hooked together. Remember that little paper I gave you about the four Maras? Seeing an event and believing it is real is the first Mara. Second, liking or disliking that event as real, second Mara. Third Mara, making plans to avoid any similar event in the future or to get any similar event. Avoid or get, right? Third Mara. Fourth Mara, major, the five poisons are all running. Greed, hatred, delusion, pride, and jealousy. There's continuous plots, and I'm going to get this, I'm going to do that, oh, don't talk to them, he bought a Chevrolet last year, you know? Just poof, gone, lost. The I is what is occurring. The I is solid. And the flowing dance of all potential is gone. But the truth is, the flowing dance is always there. But I choose to continue. So even if it falls tails, I see hands after one.
Sorry, what did you say?
I'm sorry. Suspicious and throw the coin out.
Oh, yeah. Start a society. Scientific, of course. You betcha. In fact, one of the things that has the most power over rebirth from a Buddhist point of view is your habitual emotional and mental states day after day after day. It's not your 20 minutes of meditation. It's the 23 hours and 40 minutes of non-meditation. And that isn't entirely true, because that 20 minutes of meditation can color your 23 hours quite a lot. But in another way, it is very true. It's the habituated states, the habituated judgments, the habituated emotional patterns that have the strongest voice. So, in a future lifetime, we'll see whoever Ottawa is making, panning for gold in some magnificent wilderness.
Well, wait a
with
minute.
With bikinis dancing around him.
I pan gold for the piece of it, not for to...
Well, exactly.
Because I can't get much from the river, so I just do it for the piece.
Yeah, well, you'll get the piece. You know, every pan will be just be full of piece, and there'll be pieces of gold, too. Yeah, I know. Piece. Either that or you'll be a caribou. I'm not sure. You'll be a caribou. Oh, that's interesting.
I was just thinking that maybe, I guess, like,
working the rocks and the sand, and like it's almost a little bit like a mandala offering too.
Sure,
I
it
guess.
Is. Sure, especially if you consciously think of it like that.
Yeah, because it requires a lot of attention. You know, all your attention.
And every time you find a little flick of gold, you think this is bodhicitta.
Well, it's like you. It's like eliminating, and then you're getting down. Then you have to concentrate more and more as the gold is showing itself, and then you have to really be there. And it's almost like every fleck you have to really watch and baby and push it back and work it, and then you're happy when it's all over.
But the concentration feels wonderful, doesn't it?
Hmm? Yeah, it's satisfying, yeah.
Concentration is wonderful. Yeah. In the mandala offering, the concentration is the precious queen. It's very satisfying, fulfilling, supportive, joyous. Doesn't nag or bitch, you know. The thoughts slow right down when you're concentrating, right? Now, I think that statement about what it is, what drives you, that shapes you, is like just exactly, you know, very, very worth looking at in my life, and I would imagine in your lives too. These views are so easy to just sort of carry on day after day, when in fact you don't even like them anymore, you know? You really actually don't really like them anymore, if you actually looked at them. A lot of them are long outworn, aren't they?
Yeah, but even when we become aware that we have views that we don't like, we still continue in them. Even though we
but if you actually pay attention to when that view is starting to operate, you have more of a choice, don't you? And you can also begin to see the emotional clinging to it, can't you?
I think so.
And once you can see the emotional clinging, then you actually have the power to change something. Mm-hmm. You have the choice about whether to pretend you don't have that view, always. Or have the choice to say, I'm going to hold that view, but I'm not going to put it on others. Always. Yeah. There is always a choice. I know often people say to me that they don't have a choice, but I don't see them as that different from me. And I know that if I'm really honest, I always have a choice. It's whether or not I was willing to pay attention enough. Take it, or whether I just wanted to just indulge myself either in the emotion or in the view, or both. If there was not always a choice, there would be no possibility of awakening. Mm-hmm. But there is a possibility of awakening. Ergo! Choice!
Does it help to think of it as it helps me a bit? I think of it as relating not from the mind, but when I catch myself of relating to the mind, relating to what is arising. And when I come out of a good sit, it works, and there's a quietness, and there's a little distance from the thoughts, or like background, that I can notice the character of them, but I'm not quite so attached to them. I'm looking at them with kind of an interest, and relating to that mind, which is not my mind. But it's there. It's running a show, really. Going into it that way seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you're not relating from it, that is to say that it's riding you.
No.
You're relating to it. You're riding it.
It seems to result.
Is that, would that,
yes.
Hello?
Yes. I think it's based on your mind, your emotional set before you start. You're calm. Well,
according to Buddhism, they're totally tied together.
Yeah.
View and emotion are totally tied together.
Yeah.
That if there is a partial view, there will be a conflicting emotion.
Mm-hmm.
According to Buddhism, they're both there, and that's why the Buddha said there are two veils that obscure reality. And in one beautiful Tibetan text, which I unfortunately can't remember, they use that analogy over and over again of like drawing the curtain of the veils. Drawing the curtain, which, you know, it just is like, just seems to me so very clear.
Seems such a clear night coming out.
Yeah. Drawing the curtain of being ridden by one's views and the emotions that stick one to that position. The fear of letting them go. There's often a lot of fear in letting a fixed view go. and again, in the Christian Bible, I think it's in Proverbs, but I don't exactly remember. I'll have to look that up. There's a very beautiful statement, when a lion eats a man. Do you remember me quoting this to you before? When a lion eats a man, do you remember this? Lion is the king of the beasts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a man is supposedly the ruler of the beast, right? When a lion eats a man, he is cursed. Well, that would be true. But then it says, but when a man eats a lion, the man is blessed. That is to say, when you are being swallowed by all that is ignorant and bestial in you, you're cursed. But when you are able to operate with that inside you, but your own mind, the mind that is human, the mind that can make choices, is the eater, is the winner, you know, is riding that, then that's a blessing. And to me, that's like, and certainly I don't think that proverb is talking about good restaurants or what takeout you should go for, you know. It's talking about very specifically this same thing in the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's talking about exactly the same thing, that either you can be swallowed by the ignorant, continuous, ongoing, hungry, unending, slavering beast of samsara, of blind wandering, cause and effect without ever making a choice. Or you can watch that happening within you and make choices. That's what it says to me. It seems very straightforward. And in some way or other, I hear that from every teaching I have ever heard. You always have a choice. One of the biggest lies that people tell themselves is that they missed their chance. But that's not true. As long as you're moving, you have not missed your chance. And even when you leave your body, if you're a Buddhist, you haven't missed your chance. There is no such thing as too late. It does not exist. It's a convenient way to practice self-pity, but you don't have to practice self-pity because I've already done that. See, I saved you from that one. And you could never do it as well as I did it. I'm better at self-pity than any of you, although sometimes you give me a run for your money. Not my money, your money. So, give it up. It's never too late. The circumstances are never impossible. Self-pity is mine, saith the Cecily. How's that? Waxing poetic. It won't work, you know? It's a rotten hiding place because I'm there already. I've explored it thoroughly, and I'm not going to be confused by it. Is that clear? Yeah, it's one of the things I explored very thoroughly. So forget too late. Forget no choice. Because both of them are not true. That is a convenient story to tell yourself so you can sit on your butt. And indulge what you don't want to let go of. And what I'm saying to you is, sit on your butt. Indulge what you don't want to let go of. And watch yourself do it. Know that you have chosen to do that. Know that that is your choice. Give yourself the power you actually have and acknowledge your power. It doesn't matter how big the lion is. You can still swallow it. All you have to do is watch. You don't have to change anything. I think that's so brilliant. Don't you think so? It's like so brilliant. You don't have to change anything. You just have to bring awareness into it. As soon as you bring awareness into it, everything will change itself. In Buddhism, they say awareness is a power. So maybe that's what you mean, Morris. When you finish sitting, you can watch the thoughts. You're not caught by them. Exactly. Because there's more awareness there.
There's the stillness of energy and quietness.
Yeah, you're not caught in being driven by.
Mm.
Driven by I. You're not so attached to the thoughts. They are not I. Yeah. And that's the only choice you need. That's the only choice you need. Shall I be aware or shall I not be aware? Shall I fall into the habitual sense of self with all its emotional patterns? Or shall I say this is the first time the coin is ever flipping? Shall I say it's landed heads 50 times, so this time it must land tails, oh poor me? Or shall I say, you never know? Do you ever see that play or read that play, that beautiful play where they do that thing with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that brilliant? I love that play. They do that. That's how they start it. That's where I learned that. Flip a heads 51. Heads 52. Gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Yeah, this wonderful dialogue. Do you know the play? It's about what. So this is like a play about the characters backstage, as if when they walk on. It's a brilliant. It's just brilliant. It's wonderful.
It's a movie. It's on video.
Is it?
Really? Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yes,
it is. Great. Oh well. Hey. Okay, class is over. Video.
Blockbuster.
You will find if you start taking one of your favorite views and just changing one or two words in it, you know, just change one or two words in it when it starts to play, you'll be able to see the emotion that is hooked into it really easily. So how are we doing? Anything else you want?
I just like it when we don't have that much to explore and you just
keep on going, blah, blah, blah. Nice. Keep on going, blah, blah, blah. Hmm. Well, you know, with the emotional part of it, because I've talked mostly about the view, with the emotional part of it, what happens to us in our emotional states is we do not recognize that our emotions, depression is an emotion, anger is an emotion, that our emotions are actually what cause us to be radiant. That is our link, our genetic link, our cousins, the angels. If you say our cousins, the apes, you have to say our cousins, the angels too. That there is an aspect of our being that is angelic. And that is the emotional. The emotional body, the emotional energy of our being. But we don't tend to see what kind of angel we're being. Or how certain parts of ourselves we allow to be angelic and certain parts we just cut off. Because there are emotional states that of experiences that occurred, say when you were a child or something, where you felt that you weren't, it wasn't approving for you to do this, you were supposed to do that all the time, and there was this continuous maybe criticism coming or something like that, right? So certain desires, certain emotional energies, certain desires got kind of capped. And then the consciousness learned to use the muscles a different way. And so then that parts of the body began to like turn down the energy here and move it around there. So when you're doing things like a sadhana, where you're visualizing a radiant being, there are times when you'll be visualizing that. If you're a real dictator, you know, you can make yourself totally whole, an absolute complete image of that deity. And then one day, if you're really lucky, your dictatorial approach will just drop and you'll actually see the deity with maybe a shoulder missing or half their face floating off somewhere here, or you will actually see the deity as the mirror of the angelic part of your own being, or the emotional part of your own being. And when you do that, you get the opportunity to accept yourself. And when you do that, of course, all the emotional pain is released. You know, when with Pogo we have found the enemy and he is us, and then you embrace that, then the emotional pain is released. So it's not uncommon, you know, for people who have real difficulties with emotion that whenever they meditate, they fly all over the universe and they experience 15,000 galaxies faster than a speeding bullet, more powerfully than a throbbing locomotive. And their deities always have, you know, extremely, you know, every little whirl on their awakened skulls is totally going clockwise or counterclockwise as it should be. Do you understand? They are more and more and more detailed, and then all of a sudden one time that will just pop and there'll be a skeleton suit. And that will be what really they feel. Or something. And mirror-like wisdom refers more to the emotional nature of consciousness than to the view nature. In my experience, and that could be certainly everything I say is probably not accurate, but that I would be very suspect of. That's just my opinion.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by radiant.
What do you understand by radiance? What do you understand by radiance?
That, like when you say the emotion is
The radiant body.
The radiant body. I'm not really sure what the radiant body is. I don't know what that means.
Do you know what radiant means?
It's like...
To emit.
To emit.
Yeah, energy of some type, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Yeah.
I guess I do understand.
Yeah. And every emotion is a different emission. And you react totally to how I am emoting. I react totally to how Morris is emoting. Morris reacts totally to how June is. In fact, all of us react totally to how all of us are emoting in this room. Right? Which is why experiences like loving kindness or things like that work, because you feel somebody's anger and you immediately center yourself and work with kindness. And so their energy is influenced by that. Why, if you come across somebody who is hysterical and you're also hysterical, it makes three people who are hysterical, not just two. I really like the Buddhist statement, I too use concepts, but I'm not fooled by them. I'm not fooled thereby. I'm not fooled by them. It's such a, this is a, such a, an amazing thing to be able to say that. To be able to use concepts, to be able to use beliefs. And have the sense of joy of just letting them go again. Be like catching birds and letting them go, you know? Catching birds with a sense of real beauty and then letting them go, well fed. I use concepts and a lot of the time I'm fooled by them. And then I find that what feels, what is the felt sense of truth, what is the experiential understanding of truth, is stumbling over my views.
Well, with all sorts of props and sticks and
yeah,
cement.
Yeah.
Everything to present the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Dangerous walking, hey. Yeah.
Somebody pulls one up and
yeah.
Comes falling down.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So incredible that he would say that, isn't it? I do use concepts, but I'm not fooled by them. The kind of freedom of that. Because I don't think he misuses, he isn't saying I too you misuse concepts. You know? I think there's a real sense of respect for the naming mind in that statement that he makes. You know? I think that there is a real understanding of the compassion that is required to name well. If you're going to name well, it requires great compassion, I think.
I think this feeling of this comes from a much abused word, attitude. I was speaking to some, I was on my name, and some research people, I was doing some newspaper work at Cambridge, just in a funny position because nobody knows what you're doing. And they're all in your hands. And you march on with theories, which may or may not be true. So how do you feel about your theories? So all we really try to inculcate in communities is that at this moment, given all that is happening here, it seems logical to suppose that this would probably go this way. But we don't know. We're willing to be surprised. In fact, we'll be delighted if someone comes up with another theory that makes us re-examine this one. A whole explorative sense of looking at connections, not as a final answer.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems a pretty rare, I think.
Yeah, and that was earlier days, wasn't it, Morris, before the marketplace was so well developed, wasn't it?
Dedicated.
There was a more of an opportunity of not being bought in those times.
Yeah.
And the temptations are harder, I think. People are more likely to believe. Believe the story of necessity, and people don't believe they have choice anymore. I think many people don't believe they have choices. I think many people don't believe that they could say, no, I don't want a job. You know?
Yeah.
That beautiful Polish poet who won the Pulitzer Prize for her poetry, she has a wonderful poem that talks about how she it's called I believe in the turning away or something. She talks about how she believes in the scientist who gets up one day and goes to his lab and makes the great discovery and burns his papers and confuses his experiment and destroys all of the preliminary work living up to it and gets rid of all the evidence and goes home and pretends he was sick in bed all day. The right to not I believe in the right to not speak. And isn't that an interesting idea, you know? That if you really believe in concepts but you're not fooled by them, you also have to be able to let them go, not chase them, not think that a concept is worth everything. You have to be able to see how they can blind. And that's something that, you know, I don't think we really pay attention to. Because we're very impressed by intelligence. Aren't we? Bigger, brighter, faster. Right?
Who's referred to as?
Who's got the best portfolio? Right? The greatest money making scheme. It's almost as if we didn't know we lived on an island. It's almost as if we didn't want to recognize those pictures of the Earth from space. Or we believe that you can infinitely run around faster and faster and faster, passing one potato so everybody has it at some time. So everybody thinks that they've got one potato and nobody is ever tempted to take a bite. It's somehow something about that mentality.
Okay.
Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you understand what I'm talking about?
The interesting thing that I'm picking up on is Chartan Rinpoche, who is a Nyingma Bach, interesting fellow. And he's written a book on time, space, and
yes.
And he talks about thoughts having a dynamic of their own. And once you get into them, the concept, it can develop a whole scenario. Because they'll just take you with them. And they're reinforced and cemented and cross-pollinated by everybody in that same stream.
Yeah.
And you haven't invented any of them, but you're doing this playing with them.
Mm-hmm. That's the meme idea again. Do you see that?
Yeah.
It's the same idea. I'm sure that's going to come booming out any time now. Is rather than sideline science, or in Jungian terms, the archetype. Anyway, how's that?
Cecily?
Yes.
With these maras, when the maras are like activated and starting to happen in that, like, should a person just be aware of them and be non-clinging to them and just...
Just name it. So all you have to do is become aware.
And let them do their play or whatever.
Well, they'll stop right away. It's immediately changed. The minute you actually realize that that's happening and just watch, just practice awareness, the whole scenario has already changed. In Buddhism, they say awareness is a power. Now, I would like you to tell me next time we meet whether you think that's true.
Well,
I would like you to explore it like for a month and tell me whether you think awareness is a power. Will you do that?
Well, awareness is powerful. I know that. I know awareness is powerful when you become aware of it, because it seems to have its own color. I don't know. It's own power.
Everything changes.
Yeah.
Everything has changed. As soon as you bring awareness in, everything changes.
But I find that sometimes a person can sort of go ahead and work and always come back and focus to something, but I'm almost like really wondering, you know, like a person can get kind of dull after a while.
That's true.
Because they're just doing this, well, having this is so important, and just sort of doing that as the main thing, but I don't know. It's sort of, to me anyway, it sort of seems like it sort of separates everything too, in a way.
What does? What it?
Just doing my own practice all the time, being aware and all that. And,
it does separate you from many people. That's true. That is true. There are many people I know who at one time called me friend, who would walk across the street if they saw me coming now. Because they wouldn't know what to say to me. Or...
Yeah.
Which is probably why you practice the mandala offering. You have to be willing to give everything away. If you really want to see what is true, you do really have to be willing to give everything away. Am I actually talking to what you about what you're talking about?
But then, I'm sort of curious what happens then.
Yes, exactly. Well, it isn't so much what happens then, it's the real truth that everything is going to be taken away from you anyway.
Uh-huh.
When you're probably less willing to give it away.
It's interesting. I mean, it's
everything that you've got, you're only is only on loan.
Mm-hmm.
including your name, your thoughts. No. You understand that?
Mm-hmm.
So you're being asked to give it all away. Be willing to give it all away in order to see what is true. Would that be reasonable?
Yeah,
what is true?
Yeah.
Is that
but
a reasonable aspiration for you?
There's no passion. I feel that, you know, there used to be, like, by sadhana, when I used to do sadhana, there used to be lots of passion, but now it just seems like it's just, that's why I'm a little bit wondering, like, maybe I'm just getting dull or something, you know, everything's being jaded, or am I, you know, like, because there's not a whole lot of passion anymore.
Mm-hmm. So, what sadhana are you doing?
Well, just what I can figure out to do, what's appropriate at that time.
So what are you doing now?
Well, not getting caught in inflicting emotions and trying to, you know, be peaceful and trying to just be a good boy.
That sounds very boring.
It is.
That sounds very boring. Maybe it's boring because you're not actually interested. Maybe it's boring because you're bringing in rules. Have you got too many rules?
It's almost like I'm hiding behind all these things.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So it sounds to me like you've got all this list of things you should or shouldn't do, there's no room for you, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, the one way to get rid of passion is to bury your interest in a bunch of formulas. The one way to be passionate about something is to be interested. You know?
Uh-huh.
It is the idea that drives you, that shapes you. And so if you have shaped into somebody who has got a whole lot of ideas about what they should be doing, you're being driven by an idea that you're supposed to be other than you are. You understand me?
Okay.
And if that's the idea that's shaping you, then who you are must be not worth being around. So if you're sitting there with yourself trying to be all these things and it's boring, I don't blame you. You know? That's who you're creating. You know, that's the idea that's driving you. But, you know, and that's the idea that unconsciously interests you. Now bring some consciousness into it and be interested in how you feel at any moment. And you'll start to notice when you have interest or when you don't. Which is what I said to you last night. Feel yourself in space. Become aware of yourself in space, right? And then practice kindness. Right?
Which is
so
love.
Feel yourself in space, yeah, and practice kindness means, and then don't immediately say, I should be this way or I shouldn't be that way. Here I am in space, and it's a great space. Right? And then you watch. Interest will just be right there, like that. Interest will be present again. And then pay attention to what you're interested in. Where did that shaping come from? Your interest is also a shaping. It comes from previous times. You know, how come Mozart? How come? You know Mozart, eh? How come? How old was he when he wrote his first thing, me?
No, pretty young, yeah.
Three? Disgusting, right? How come? what interests you shapes you. Right. You want to be the Mozart of passion? Start practicing interest. Next lifetime, instead of a... gazelle, it'd be the Mozart of passion. Whoever you may be. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Mm-hmm. I'm saying, if that what has happened is that there is boredom, it's because you have somehow killed the interest. Because you were originally interested. Now there's all kinds of experiences or rules or clingings, you know, it's not the first time anymore. You're not flipping the coin and getting heads for the first time. You're flipping the coin and doing the same practice, and will I do it right this time? Do you understand me?
Mm-hmm.
There is an idea about what it's supposed to be good for and who's going to be good at doing it, right? Does that make sense to you? Is that true?
Well, it's more of a fear of what you feel is right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But where is the sense of exploration in that? There's already a preconceived idea of what it's supposed to do, right? The practice should do this, or I should... Hmm?
Or, yeah, how I should be.
So how can you be interested if what you're trying to do is basically suicide? Kill your own self. You know, how I should be means how I am is not that. Doesn't it? It's like just sort of taking a carving knife. Okay, this is called meditation. Where's my switchblade? Yeah, that's right. I carve myself up into it. That's not meditation. You know? Is it? I don't think so. Do you understand me?
Uh-huh.
Now, I know you were a butcher. But don't take the habit of work into the practice. Wrong. Take the habit of practice into the work. Okay?
Okay, but it's boring, man.
It's boring? All right, so then I suggested to you yesterday a practice to do, didn't mm-hmm. I?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Have you been doing that?
Yeah, but just more as in thought rather than bringing my whole experience of really, like, manifesting.
Being present?
Really manifesting.
Well, don't do it in thought. I mean, thought is so boring. Pretend you're actually here.
I don't think you would.
Well, in that case, of course, I can't.
I've heard you say that you've done it before.
There's probably a couple of people in this room that could attest to that. Although I am getting kinder in my own.
But this is what
less believing that it's possible to make a change. I'm not sure which.
This is what I mean, like getting kinder, it's almost like it seems like it's boring. You know?
Yeah, but it should not be. And so if it is, then there is something that you are not allowing your own interest to be present. What you have to do is look for what interests you. That's why become aware of yourself in space. If you do that, you should notice what interests you and practice kindness. You should begin to notice what interests you. Interest should come up from that. It should work. That's why I asked you to do it. not theoretically. Do not do it with your thoughts. Do it with your whole being. Like there was a little interest there as you were skidding off sideways there. Wasn't there, getting away from your tape recorder? Wasn't there?
Yeah. To stay dry.
Yeah, and that was interest, wasn't it? And there was aliveness too, eh? Wasn't there?
Yeah.
And a certain playfulness, right? And another part that didn't like it. Right?
Uh-huh.
Aha! Yeah. I rest my case. You'll just have to draw your own conclusions from that. Go for what interests you. Do that by actually allowing yourself for the first time ever, right now, poof, arising in space. Just as if I was going to pick up that water and throw it at you. I missed.
Give me a little bit.
Back to the range for you, bro.
I'm so sorry, Otto.
You probably were practicing kindness.
I think that was unkind, actually. I've got some tea left. Okay?
Okay.
So you actually remember to see yourself, just like right then when the water was coming, right? Just remember, just to see yourself right then. Be present. You are present now, look it. And you're actually interested. Do you see that? Forgetting Terry giggling or all that shit. You can feel yourself present, right? There's energy there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because you're interested. You have that switch for interest, non-interest, in your own being. That's not something outside here. It would be a terrible thing if you allowed yourself to forget to use that switch unless somebody was dumping concrete on you or throwing water. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's there with every shift of light that is always possible, just to be interested. With every beat of the heart, with every breath, there is always that choice. That's called awareness. Who is it in the seven factors of enlightenment in the Tibetan tradition? Who is it that is Dhamma Vichaya, investigation, interest, investigation? He's the one that finds treasure that is hidden underground. No interest means everything is made to look the same. Interest is when you start saying, oh yeah, it may look the same, but there's gold in them there hills. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Am I?
Yeah, true. Yes, true. But sometimes when you give yourself the interest, there seems to be so much expectation that goes along with that.
Okay, so be interested in why you think you should listen to the expectation. You know, if you have noticed that at a certain point in interest you start expecting a result. Okay, Uli said I was going to awaken in 52 minutes, and it's 51 3/4 minutes. Right?
Uh-huh.
Or whatever. Whatever! Sammy came by with 3 hot dogs and said if I ate 2 of them, I would achieve major samadhi. Whatever! Okay, if I spin around 3 times on my left toenail, I will suddenly have totality vision, you know, Tathagata Garba will land on my head like pigeon shit. Choo, choo, choo. So then at that point you think, what is this expectation? Does it come up in every moment? Because isn't that interesting? Yes. You know, if you're a donkey following a carrot of something that's going to be given to you, at some point you can say to yourself, what is that carrot? If I turn my head this way, is there immediately a carrot there? Do you understand? Mm-hmm. You can say, oh, I refuse to go after it anymore. I don't believe in carrots. But it is a carrot. So what is it? What is expectation? It is your choice to believe that if you do this, some great reward will come. It's your choice to ignore the stick that is holding the carrot up in front of you. You know? It is my choice to believe that someday if I do everything good, some kind of weird god somewhere in some kind of realm is going to come down and bestow on me a great blessing and everything's going to be okay and it will happen poof out of nowhere when as far as I can see, everything in my own being, everything outside shows me that nothing comes out of nothing. Whatever has arisen has cause, and if enlightenment is possible, it must be here. So why is it I'm trying to do right when all I really need to do is be here? Is that clear? Why do you want carrots? Because they're good for eyesight. Okay. You do your eye exercises, is it? There's a carrot bobs in front of me.
Well,
do you understand why I'm saying that? Oh, my pins are coming. I'm coming unpinned. Oh, no. Do you understand why I'm saying that?
I thought I did. I don't know. Maybe I lost them.
Oh, maybe you did.
Well, being here, just being here, is that somehow connected with bodhicitta too?
Yes.
Thank you.
So that's my tea. Do you have another question? The beautiful light in your heart shines through your body above, below, in front, behind. Right, left, four quarters. Pours out through your pores. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, it's just temporarily assuaged, and you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, others. Whatever awesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is this. Whatever awesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is this. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you. Mm-hmm.